Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com, on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. Happy New Year! This is going to be our first episode of 2021, which we are praying, whether we are religious or not, will be not 2020. Big hardcore prayers up that your 2021 has been glorious and wonderful and safe, most importantly. We are recording this episode in the last weeks of 2020, so I really hope between now and then everything has panned out well for most of us. But especially for our guest, the illustrious Christopher Gonzalez, who is a publishing professional, and he is the author of many wonderful short stories, and we are blessed with his short story collection in 2021 this fall called I'm Not Hungry, But I Could Eat, amazing title, forthcoming from SFWP. And Chris has a lot on his plate. He tends to do so much for other people, so much for the literary community. And he has been highly recommended to me as someone I just need to know because people love him so much. So I'm super enthusiastic that we get to talk. And I just wish that we actually could share physical space with one another. But I will very much be enlivened from this virtual space. So thank you for being here, Chris.
Thank you for having me, Jen. I'm so stoked to, like you said, finally talk to you. But I have a beer. I hope you have a drink.
And I was going to get the coquito out, but I do need to be coherent because it is strong.
then that'll be your after podcast beverage.
I'll be good with water. It'll be great. How are you feeling today, Chris?
I feel like it's the most Monday of Mondays.
Isn't it?
And every day since Thanksgiving has been a Monday, in my opinion. But I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm okay. And now that you mentioned Thanksgiving, I was like, was it that last week? And it was not.
It was not. You're right. I'm ready for this year to end. You said it in the intro. I am ready for 2021. Who knows if it'll be better? I hope. But I can't.
It'll be better because we get your story collection. So that's one wonderful thing we have to look forward to. Besides inauguration and other stuff. But I know your book is going to make waves. Your writing is just so impactful. It's so distinct. And we're going to get into that as well. But I do want to start with your full-time job because you, like me, apparently like getting a regular paycheck.
It is one of my kinks.
I was talking to somebody, and they're just, when I see folks post about this freelance life, but I was like, I can't, that's too stressful. That's just too stressful. Invoicing and keeping track of all that.
I think this is the first real year, and maybe last year too, where I'm starting to get a little money from stuff I publish, and that the invoicing and waiting for the money to deposit is not a life I want to experience like more than I already do.
Yeah, it's stressful. I mean, we're already stressed and we're BIPOC, so it's just kind of like, I like that security, quote unquote security. I know nothing's super secure, but I do like every 2 weeks reliable money.
Yeah, big fan.
So I have not had someone of your background on the podcast, so I'm additionally enthused that we get to talk to an ebook production manager. And ebooks are a big, big portion of our day-to-day. Whether people know it or not, like I understand if you look at the metrics of like, oh, the sales of ebooks are kind of quote-unquote stagnant as we've read. But ebooks are crucial in terms of accessibility, and especially now because I don't know if you deal with e-galleys for people who are listening. Those are basically advanced reader copies. And digital advanced reader copies have been the thing. Those have been our bread and butter, at least at my publisher, which is Penguin Random House. You don't have to say who yours is. It's totally fine. But yeah, it's just the amount that we have been relying on technology and electronics has been so crucial. And I don't know if that has impacted your job during quarantine in a different way in terms of quantity. Maybe it hasn't, and you know, it's been a lot of what all of us are experiencing in isolation. But A, can you talk a little bit about ebook production? Well, let's start with A, because I tend to front load.
Okay, I appreciate that. You mentioned, has it changed much during quarantine for me? I think at the very start, when publishers were trying to figure out what the hell they were doing, there was a hard pivot to e-galleys, digital galleys, which we had always been doing, but nowhere near the level, and there wasn't the same level of attention on them that there is now. I think a lot of them were still PDF form, which isn't the best for e-readers. And they looked pretty, I mean, at least for my publisher, they looked pretty janky. As a package, they look a little better now. But yeah, it's interesting sort of to see these products that we always had that make up publishing, how, you know, they didn't matter until suddenly there was no other option. Even though, like you said, I think I'm a big fan of ebooks. I'm a big supporter for the accessibility. And selfishly, I enjoy checking 20 ebooks out of a library at once and maybe reading only three. But I do like having the option to have a book at my fingertips at all times. But yeah, so I work in ebook production. And it's hard to describe what that is. I think it varies by publisher. For my publisher's purposes, I don't do much coding or anything, but I do oversee schedules for all of our trade side, some distribution clients sort of hounding down where missing files are. I'm also responsible for our day-to-day making price changes because ebooks are constantly going on promotion, and that's a manual process, at least for my publisher. I got to make all the price changes. It can be 3, it can be 4, it can be 100, depending on the day. I also handle our reprint corrections. So I'm sure for print, there's a whole process for it. For ebooks, I get the same marked up pages that you would get for print production. And if there are a reasonable amount, I'll open up the ebook and make those corrections myself. And my limited HTML knowledge can sometimes come into play. But basically, yeah, I'm just responsible for upkeep and making sure all of our ebooks, they could have published 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago. I mean, whatever 10 years ago ebook publishing looked like. And if a customer wants it and there's something wrong with it, I'm responsible for looking into it, troubleshooting it, working with our vendor to fix it, working with the retailer to sort out any issues. So it's sort of like an ongoing process for some of these titles that are super old. So it's not just frontlist heavy, it's very much backlist focused.
And that's interesting because, again, we don't really talk about ebook production. You may or may not have seen me go off on Twitter a couple times about the bookmaking team not getting credit.
Yeah, no, I saw you go off. I've seen you go off multiple times, and every time I'm like, yes, yes.
I'm like Norma Rae, what about us? What about us? Your books wouldn't exist without us. Don't leave us out of the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I think when ebooks first came on the scene, they were viewed as a competitor to print books, right? But now, I mean, they're very much, it's all going back to the profit, or I am not a money person, do not sales and all of that feed back into the book, go back into royalties and all of that. It's not a separate thing that's competing with the print book in my mind, but I think ebooks are still talked about as this like separate thing that isn't equal, but it's a product and it requires just as much care and attention, and it's cheaper to make. I'm noticing a shift to like audiobooks, which is not my realm at all, but I'm noticing how audiobooks are sort of viewed and discussed in the same way I think ebooks were like a decade ago. Oh, here's this new leg of the industry. It's growing, it's rising. Whereas ebooks now have plateaued. They weren't the threat that I guess print publishing thought they would be, though I don't see why it should have been viewed as a threat anyway. But, you know, that's a separate conversation.
Oh, we could dig in. Because I remember that time, too, when people were like, print is dead. And it's all that hearsay that happens, especially for us in the industry. We see kind of these panicky headlines that just say, is this dead? Is this gone away? Is this permanently over? Is this threatens this? And da-da-da-da-da, instead of really digging into what this actually means and how it can benefit or how it can deter or all that stuff. So it's very interesting how insider discussions happen and who controls those discussions.
Yeah, definitely.
So can you talk about how you got into ebook production, considering, again, when we do see a lot of job openings, the usual pursuits are acquisitions. And by acquisitions, I mean editorial, the kind of standard editorial that people know about. marketing and publicity. Our roles, me and managing ed, you and ebook production, and then production, maybe even copy editing, proofreading if that's in-house. And then there are also data people who do the IT and the connecting this data to upload here and appear there properly. And there are just so many facets of the industry that people can get into that don't know about. But how did you, especially as a writer and an editor, get into ebook production?
It's a great question. So my first publishing internship was in 2014. I interned with Orbit Book. It was Orbit and Yen Press at the time were like a joint publisher, I guess. One, you know, Orbit does sci-fi fantasy and Yen does manga. And it was an editorial intern. So there was some reading and all of that involved. But I knew very much I wanted time to have a creative life outside of my day job. I wanted to focus on my writing. I wanted to not be drained at the end of the day. My boss at the time, who was an editorial assistant at Orbit, she was a creative writing major. I asked her up front, how often do you write? And she said she didn't. So that was sort of like, for me, I was like, I can't do all of this. But I enjoyed through that internship packaging files, because with manga and graphic novels, there's lettering, there's InDesign files, there's assembling. And I enjoyed the assembling more than like having to be on the editorial side as far as like a day job, because I am an editor at a lit mag, but it's much more laid back. It's not being in acquisitions at a publishing house by any means. The following summer, I interned again at Hachette in their manufacturing and digital production department. And I love the process. I love learning about bookmaking rather than just the actual like, content of the books. And while I was there, I was looking for jobs because I had just graduated undergrad. And this was in 2015. And there was an opening at my current publisher house for a position that no longer exists, which was essentially ebook QA associate. And when I got that job, it was basically just doing, as it said, QA for ebooks, opening them up, reading them a little bit, not too much, just to make sure everything was clean. There wasn't anything jarring. There were no missing pages. But through that, I have been at my company for 5 years now, and I sort of worked my way in. And I enjoy the bigger picture and learning about metadata and systems. And I think this job allowed me more of that. And it's so separate from being creative. I didn't want to deplete all of my creative energy at my 9-to-5. And I think this would be different for print production, obviously, but at least in ebook production, as I've understood it for the last several years, I am able to have that like separate, fulfilling creative life.
I told Chris at the top that this is going to be a very relatable episode, that we're just going to mutually appreciate each other. And I'm going to do a lot of which I'm doing when I mute, because I feel very similarly in a lot of ways, which is also kind of adds to, at least for me, taking on so much outside of the full-time job. I wouldn't say it's a lack of fulfillment in the job itself, but I think it's also, how do we tether ourselves and find a way to still be part of the arts community and not necessarily be stressed out by a lot of demands that big publishing or book publishing in itself can make on the individual, especially as creatives. I don't know if you pursued these literary magazine gigs or if people pursued you. How did that kind of transpire as you're building your own career, which is separate? It's funny because it's connected, but it is very separate to other things, so that you're building also your editorial repertoire.
I am one of four fiction editors at Barrel House Magazine right now, and I've been with them since 2016. And my goal for joining a literary journal at the time was simply I wanted to read the slush pile. I wanted to learn about what was happening behind the curtain, and I wanted to learn why I wasn't getting published as much as I thought I deserved. And I definitely did not deserve to be published more than I did, but it was simply, I guess, self-interest in wanting to join. But also, when I first got to New York City, I didn't know how to find an entry point into a literary community. I just graduated college. I was new to the city. The only friends I had were from my college and the ones I was making in publishing, but I didn't know how to sort of penetrate the New York City literary scene, which 5 years later, I do have a community and I know so many people now. But at the time, it just seemed like, oh, big names sort of breeze through the city. and what happens to those of us who don't have a name. But through reading for Barrel House and being asked to come on as a full-time editor, which just means I'm in the discussions about events and planning and should we have a themed issue and where should we allocate funds, etc., I've gotten to know so many people outside of New York City, which somehow strangely helped me learn and helped me meet people in New York City. And then I was also, for a brief period of time, one of several contributing editors at Splitlip. And that was a case where I had published with them and worked with them. And they're a phenomenal magazine. And they just asked me to come on in this contributing editorial role where I got to solicit writers who I wanted to work with. Many of them, if not all of them, were queer by POC. And I got to, you know, help with the Flash fiction contest and just sort of give my editorial input. But that was just a example of a relationship that formed organically between me and one of the editors. It became a friendship and then it became this partnership of some sort. I'm not there. I'm not with Splitlip anymore, but that was just because I needed something to give and I love them and I'll always be looking out for them, but felt I needed to work on my own writing. With Barrel House, I wanted to be more present as an editor, and at my own job, I didn't want to completely burn out. So even though my day job doesn't at all impact my writing career, I think it's being in publishing, period, has allowed me to meet people and just stay on top of what's happening in the industry. And I'm always just looking at who are the new emerging writers who, especially writers of color, queer writers. And I think being inside the industry has made that easier than not.
And you touch on building community, which is a question, maybe you've gotten this question a lot too, and it is different in quarantine times, obviously. How you went about coming to New York and building a community, which is not an easy thing to do. And you were able to successfully do it, and not only successfully do it, but really garner a lot of favor in terms of the give and take that comes with building a community. Can you speak a little bit more to that about going to the events or maybe not going to the events? Maybe it was really in doing all this work you were doing with literary magazines and all that stuff.
Yeah, this is where Twitter definitely plays a big role in my community building over the last 5 years. Through Barrel House and through being in, you know, a literary world that is mostly online, because everyone at Barrel House, they're, you know, all over the country, and I was already on Twitter, it sort of went hand in hand with meeting writers, reading writers, and falling in love with their work, and then wanting to. There were some writers who it's like, oh, I would love to be this person's friend. And some who would just like, you know, I feel like I woke up one day and I'm like, how did I not know these people 4 years ago? They feel like lifetime friends. So Twitter was a big part in meeting new writers and sort of getting familiar with other creative types. As far as New York, if those writers who I was connecting with online lived in New York, I sort of developed the courage for if they were going to an event, also going and trying to meet them or just asking them for drinks. If I felt like we had communicated enough over tweets, if we were talking in DMs, and be like, hey, why don't we get a drink? And it's much easier to do now because I've done that so many times over the last couple of years. That's also how I expanded my network in publishing too, because when I started in ebooks, I was one of two by POC, and over the year and a half, 2 years, that the other person sort of worked remotely, so then it was like I was the only one for a little bit, and I just started asking colleagues who I interacted with over email and might have learned about through also Twitter, inviting them to lunch, getting a drink after work. So that sort of became my form of, I guess, networking. I wasn't trying to get anything out of it, so I hesitate to use networking. I was just seeking out people who I thought were cool and who were doing cool shit, either in the industry or with their own writing. And if I think over the last couple of years, there have been some cool projects that have come out of that, but also just mostly I've made a shit ton of friends who I love. So that's sort of all I did. I just reached out to people and may have been annoying and it's like, we should meet up.
But it's coming out of something that's very earnest, too. And I'm sure, maybe I shouldn't project, so I will.
I think I know what you're going to say. I think for me, and maybe you, maybe you can relate. You know when someone's not being earnest. You know yes. when someone wants something out of you. And I have especially no patience for that now, but that was never my operating mode. You know, it was, I simply wanted to meet people. And if I made a friend out of it, I did. If it turned into, oh, like this person's cool, but I feel like the way any friends are in your life is because you want them to be. So that's all I was doing. But yeah, there are so many people in this little community, because it's not big, who just want something. It's all tit for tat.
And sometimes it's not even conscious, I feel like, or have experienced, as in they will see you, they will hear great things about you. Just like I said at the top, I consistently heard so many great things about Chris, and his Twitter is hilarious. So we always talk about people's socials at the end of the episode. So please hold. And if you do not follow him, do so, because his Twitter is like, it's just great. It's great content, people. It really is.
I appreciate that.
It's consistently good content.
We could talk about it more, but yeah, just in general, I always feel like when someone compliments, I'm like, you should know I'm having a mental breakdown on Twitter at least like most of the day.
I will blame that on the quarantine, though, because this has not been universally, we have all been there for each other's breakdowns. That's in true. This year of our Lord, 2020.
That's true. March 13th. We're all falling apart, which is kind of lovely in a way.
And then we have to sell books after that. This is like, I don't believe in myself. Buy my book, please. Here's the book.
I know. Next year when my book actually comes out, I'm going to be like, I don't know. It'll look like I've emerged from like a burnt down house. Like, please, please, sir, buy my book.
Oh, man. It's like a Dickens novel. That's writers. That's being an author, friends. If you didn't
know. Yeah. It's Dickensian, and it feels that way. I'm publishing small press, and I think there's just a lot more onus on the author to sort of, you know, secure those events and push the book, which I'm excited to do from like a learning standpoint, but I know it's not going to be easy.
It's never easy, because it's also about, like, we have our communities, right? So theoretically, those are guaranteed. Theoretically, I emphasize
theoretically,
because I don't got rich friends.
same.
It's like, damn it.
I also don't expect anyone to buy the book. So if anyone does, I'm going to be delighted in any way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just like expectations low. Just
in hell.
if you buy it, that'd be great. Make sure to review it, but also. Request it from your library, please. That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then we scuttle off into our bookmaking holes with our steady paychecks. As we struggle to write the next book or whatever. Oh, man. Why this profession? I don't know.
I mean, that is the most philosophical question. I feel like this year, I'm sure every year in publishing is difficult, right? But this year, especially with everything going on, from the pivot to working from home, from watching publishers try and fail over and over again with reckoning with their white supremacy and trying to market off of especially Black writers, Black voices, but in a very, you can't trust publishing. And I think this year it's all of that all the time. And it's hard to have never felt more like a cog in the machine.
And something that I realized, like you said, with being a cog in the machine is, we are so isolated even more now that we can't even get those drinks, which can't be alcoholic. You know, if you're dry, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, you can't commiserate with people in person, right? So I feel like everything hit harder this year. Yeah. And I'm trying to connect with you online or via text, or the things I liked best are phone calls, honestly, because then I can move around rather than have to be stationary with a Zoom call. But I was realizing that, especially for, I think, our communities, we really relied on those kind of moments where we got to band together to at least talk about it and feel whole and feel like we're not alone. And now we are and aren't alone, right? And we're connecting in these virtual spaces, but it's just not the same. I guess I'm an extrovert. I like being alone at various times, but I really do gain energy from being around people. So for me, this has been even harder. And I started a new job earlier this year. And everyone's been great at the new job. Everyone's been really great. But I was like super stoked to get out of a job I hated and was in for almost a decade, to be in this space where it was very welcoming and there were a lot of perks and all this stuff. And shoot, you get taken right out of that environment where there was like snacks all the time. There was always food. We were having happy hours, like get books wherever. You know what I mean? It's just like, woo, this is a party. And then it's like, you have to stay home now for potentially ever. And I'm like, there are no snacks in my house.
There are no snacks in my house. What the fuck am I doing? I can't grocery shop.
There are
shop
no free
properly.
Snacks. Like, what do you need?
Oh my God. I need a vending machine installed in my hallway.
Right? But it's free.
Yeah.
I want those Trader Joe's Cheetos. I want just something that just sends me those Cheetos and some mango, dried mango slices. And I am good. And some peanut M&Ms. I'm making a lot of demands.
Making a lot. Is this your, what is that, a writer? Is that what it's called? Like your...
That's what we're going to demand when we do virtual talks, where your book comes out. We need you to FedEx him at least one Popeye's spicy Popeye's chicken sandwich.
Oh, you know me so well. Yes, that's all I want.
Yeah,
spicy.
It's
Popeye's
also in your bio on your website, though.
I committed, as is Oscar Isaac, probably.
You know, you just like you're claiming it, and I respect that as an author, because it's just like, someone can't come in and be like, I don't know what Chris Gonzalez wants. It's like, you know exactly what Chris Gonzalez wants, and you were lazy. That's what you are. He was adamantly publicizing what he what he's about, and you ignored it. That is willful. That is willful.
Yeah, I try to make it easy for people. I'm like, you know who I'm about, what I'm about.
Exactly. I was like, come on now. You just got to try. You just got to try. Again, very synonymous in this way. It's just like, we make our needs very plain. And if you're not listening, it's just like, I don't know why you're talking to me right now. I told you. I was like, Jen doesn't work for free, and you need to give Chris the spicy chicken sandwich from Popeyes. This is
That's it.
I mean, neither of us work for free. I want to make that plain, too. Like, I'm not advertising anything. So we got to talk about the book. We got to talk about the story collection. I'm not hungry, but I could eat. And so this is coming out again, fall 2021. I don't know if you have a day, a very specific date for that.
I believe December 1st, 2021. So like the very end of the year.
Okay. So it's a good Christmas gift.
Yes, thank you. I should spin it that way. Stocking stuffer.
I think that might also be Giving Tuesday, because, you know, Giving Tuesday comes right after Thanksgiving.
Wow. Yes. Okay. The marketing plan is building itself on this call.
Remember all those emails I got on Giving Tuesday last week. Yep. There you go.
Just come November 30th, December 1st, expect to get a lot of spam emails from one Christopher Gonzalez. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, and there'll be lead up. We'll remind you. We'll actively remind you. We'll get you some partnerships. It's going to be great. But can you talk a little bit about how this collection came together? Because you've been publishing stories. And so I don't know if it's a little bit of those, mostly new stuff or anything like that. But you're also agented and you're publishing this with an indie press. And so I don't know if you want to speak to all of that, because obviously there's still so much to do as a book hits our shelves. But A, the questions I asked about your short stories, is this a lot of older stuff, quote unquote, or like a lot of new stuff that we may not have seen in publications? And B, how do you feel about the short story form? Because I adore short stories. I feel like I'm a short story writer, even though some people disagree with me. They're like, I feel like you're a novelist. And I was like, shut your face. I am a short story.
Don't you dare insult me.
How
like
dare you?
Well, yeah. So to speak to A, it is mostly previously published stuff, which I think I'm coming to terms with. I was really nervous about that. I'm glad it landed at a small press because I think a bigger publisher would have wanted more newer things. Maybe. I'm speculating. Most of it's been published, but there are two previously unpublished stories that will be in it. There is one story that was in print that I'm sure no one read. You know what I mean? And one story that was published, but because of a creepy editor at a journal, I pulled it in solidarity with other people. So it's not available online anymore. But the majority has been previously published. Some of them have been retouched a little bit and edited. But I think in conversation, it feels new. When I read through all of them together, it feels like a longer, intentional project, even though I would say I didn't realize I was working towards this collection until 2 or so years ago. And at that point, I started being more intentional with the types of stories I was writing, the themes I was exploring, because I wanted the collection to be about, it's about friendship, it's about body image issues, it's about being queer, but in the space of not being fully out, developing feelings for friends that are stronger than platonic, but not quite romantic. It's in this weird gray area. I had been working on the collection for 5 years without realizing it. I was approached by an editor at SFWP, Monica Prince, who is a phenomenal editor and poet. She writes choreo poems. Look up her work if you aren't familiar. And she just simply asked me, we had discussed before what our current projects were, because I had worked with her and gotten to know her through conferences, and she's like an extended friend of Barrel House. But she was in a position to acquire, so she reached out to me, and I said, I'm working on it. I told her a little bit about it, and she told me to send it her way. At the same time, unrelated, shortly after that, I was in conversation with my now agent, Ashley Lopez, and it was a weird thing I didn't know how to navigate, because essentially the book was, you know, if I turned it in and they said yes on it, it was a done deal. But I had this agent who was interested in reading the longer project. So I sent it to her. She agreed to sign me for my next project. So ultimately, I'm signed with my agent for my next book, whatever that may be. And the small press that has the rights to the short story collection, which I didn't know was a thing that could be done. But I think a large part of my being a writer and being in the world is tripping and stumbling and figuring shit out and making it up as I go along. So that's what I landed on. And to answer your question about how do I feel about the short story form, I also adore it. And I love short story collections because even if I feel a little bit, sometimes I'm writing the same story 12 times, it's like 12 different angles. And I think each one can expand on and illuminate a theme. And in conversation, they build something greater than the sum of its parts. And that's what I love about story collections specifically. But I love short fiction so much.
I adore it. And I agree with you. And I don't know if you read Danielle Evans' new collection.
Oh my God. Yes.
Right?
Oh my God.
So freaking phenomenal. And it's sadly one of the few collections I was able to read this year. But yeah, her stuff is, oh my God, it's ridiculous. It's just so powerful. And how she looks at it so critically and analytically and philosophically, it's wonderful.
Yeah, that was the last collection I also read, I think last week. Finished it and was just like in full body chills and needed to talk to someone about it immediately. But it was like 2 a.m. So who was I going to talk to?
You know, depending on the day, I might have been up. I might not have been on Twitter, but I might have been up.
I think I ended up, I tweeted about it. I was just like, this is the first book of fiction like that I had read in so long that I felt this, I don't know, energized by. And people were just praising it. It's definitely top three books for me of 2020.
Yeah, so good, so good. And even just talking to her about process, I was like, wow, you think really hard about this. You're amazing. I just love you. you're trying to be chill, but trying to, you know, have a conversation, but at the same time, you're just like dumbfounded about their brilliance and just like, kind of like Adam Sandler in like SNL skit. There was this Adam Sandler SNL skit, I don't know if you remember, and he was a really bad interviewer with people. Like, ask the most basic questions or something. Like, I don't remember. I don't think it was like a full-on character, but it was something. It came up in repetition on occasion, and I just think about that when I'm just like, so you write stories.
That's so. I feel that. I did an interview for Electric Lit for the first time this year. I interviewed Brian Washington about talking.
That was your first for Electric Lit?
That was my first for Electric Lit. And what? I was nervous.
It's such a good interview. And Memorial is such a good book. And I'm psyched for your one with Marcos.
I'm so stoked to talk to him. Marcos is a really good friend, so I think it'll be a fun interview. But I just read his book, Marcos Gonzalez's Pedro Siri, which comes out in January from Melville House. And I was just like, I had to DM him the next day. I was like, I need you to know how much I love this book and how amazing it is. And I'm excited for other people to read that too.
Yay, the other Gonzalez, but with an S.
But with an S.
Yes. Remember that, people.
S first. the first V is an S.
Yes.
Marcos.
So a little bit more about I'm not hungry, but I could eat. You said that as you're reading it, they all feel new to you. And so in terms of, I don't know how much collaboration happened in terms of that, in terms of organizing and structuring the collection itself. But did you kind of have anything in mind, or did it kind of start coming to you as you were thinking about the essence and thematic elements within your stories of how you really wanted that to be structured?
I always thought about it like a CD, like an album. Thinking about it, I mean, the album I think about specifically, like Adele's 21, right? It goes on this whole narrative arc. And I thought, if I could do that with a short story collection, there are 15 stories, even though there aren't. It's not all the same character for all 15 stories, but I think they're all going through something similar. So I had a structure in mind. I gave it to my editor, and during edits, she was like, this structure needs to change. But we got on a Zoom call. We had a lot to drink, and we chatted about it. And we sort of, I think my final story was correct. My central story was correct. My opening story, it just needed to be swapped for the one that came after it. Which was a stronger opening. Through talking to her, got to see how these stories, through her eyes and sort of looking at them freshly, seeing how they played off each other and why the middle sections in between the beginning, middle, and end needed to be reshuffled a little. So that was a fun process. And I think ultimately where we landed works best for the book.
I hesitate to ask about what's next because I feel as though writers don't like that.
I know. I'm not going to say explicitly, just that I am trying to work on something longer. If you call it a novel, that's on you, not me. And more short stories. Even if I'm directing my energy toward a longer project, I think I still think in short fiction, if that makes sense. The ideas still come to me.
Absolutely does.
So I think I'll always sort of, even if I don't complete them, make time for them.
Yay. I'm happy to hear that because I want more stories from Christopher Gonzalez.
Thank you.
We need these. We need these stories.
I really appreciate that. And I think in an ideal world, when I'm thinking about what comes next, it's like, I want to be the writer who does the sold two books deal in Publisher's Marketplace. And it's like a novel and a short story collection, when like the novel will be the vehicle for selling that short story collection rather than the other way around. But that's like, if things work out the way I want them to, that would be what I want to happen next, whenever that happens.
You seem like a very contemplative writer because, and I'm not judging anyone in this regard, some people are very kind of business savvy in that way, and that they can right product. And that doesn't mean they dislike the product or they don't put effort into it. I think that those of us who are really trying to find the right thing we want to spend our time on and really want to love it. And that is not something you can really schedule in, right? Per se. And just like, I know my next book's going to be a novel about, I don't know, something in history. And then you start writing that. It's like, I can't stand this book, but I said I was going to do it, so I'm going to do it. And you're just like, well, that's not good.
No, I mean, especially because I think this is something we probably have in common too, because we have the stable paycheck and the steady job and limited time, we can sort of be more picky about what we devote our creative energy on, right? I don't want to labor through a novel that I hate. I will ditch a project because I have the luxury to ditch a project. And I like that, even if I complain about the day job on Twitter, I like that I'm in a position where I'm financially comfortable enough to not need writing to be my income. And if it ever becomes that, you know, I'm sure this would be a different conversation, but at least for right now, I enjoy getting to sort of follow my whims.
So my last question, as you've been very generous with your time, because you've managed to be in all these areas, and I feel successfully be in all these areas, as in, you know, you're well respected, you know, you're being able to follow through in the way that you see fit in terms of your career and maintaining your creativity and your creative presence. Do you have advice for people? And maybe this is, again, touchy because we are in quarantine time, for how people can look into understanding who they are as writers. And by that, I mean, like you said, you knew that you wanted a job like this so that you can protect your creative space, but that you pursued meeting people on a very genuine level. And maybe that's just inherent to your personality, so it's not a fair question, because maybe that's just an individual thing. Considering I think we both get a lot of questions, and we probably get a lot of people reaching out to us wanting to know things about how to find this and how to do this and all that stuff. Do you have any advice for how people might be able to just kind of gain some confidence or understanding of who they are as writers?
Wow. Yeah. No, I think the biggest or the most important thing I've come to learn about myself over the last 5 years of being in a literary community as an editor and also writer trying to sort of build a community is just be honest with yourself about what it is you don't like to do, which I think you only learn that through trying new things. So I always recommend that if there's a position to read for a literary journal, if you see an opening to apply for it, I think it's important to learn about, you know, what happens behind the scenes to get a feel for the process and make some connections in that way, meeting other editors and other writers. But if you hate it, don't keep doing it. I think you have nothing to lose by trying different things if you are open to the fact that there might not be a direct end result from any one of those things, which is to say, I feel like I'm not making any sense, but I think...
No, you are. You absolutely are. Yeah.
To be open to opportunity and learning, but being open also means that maybe some things aren't for you and that's okay. And not working a full-time editorial job, that wasn't the route for me, but there were other things I could do. If you don't write every day, don't beat yourself up over not writing every day. Like, I think there's no one way to be a writer, so forcing yourself, you don't have to network if you don't want to, but then there's the question of how do you form a community? And maybe to your point about it being like organic, I think it's just a matter of how do you go about any of this in your non-writerly life. My writer friends who I reached out to for drinks and got to know that way, it was the same way I would meet friends at work. So that doesn't help for quarantine, but I think it's just not treating it like it's a separate thing. For me anyway, it's so a part of my everyday life at this point. I'm sure there are people who would say, make a plan, be strategic. And I think you can be intentional, but it's not the same as like having a strategy. And I hope that helps at all. But I just think it's be open, and it's okay if certain avenues aren't the ones for you. And maybe through trying something that you didn't think you would like, you might learn that you do. Just to give examples, I've done panels and I've now trying to interview writers, and those are things I was terrified of. But the opportunity came along and I took it and decided it's something I want to try a little more. So I think just being open and honest about what it is you like and don't like. And the last thing I would add is be kind. And I think, that should go without saying, but just treat everyone literally as you would want to be treated. Don't use people. Don't try to, just be open and those connections will come. I think you don't have to force them.
That's great advice. It absolutely makes sense. And I think it bodes you better results. That's my thinking.
Yeah, for sure. I think this, again, this community is so small, but within that, I want a pocket of people whose company I enjoy and who I also feel build me up, not only as a writer, but as a person, right? And who can hold me accountable and who I can hold accountable in return. And those relationships are hard to come by, but only come about when you are operating from a very genuine place, I think.
I also think that's a great note to end on. It's very uplifting. I feel good. You feel good? I feel good.
I feel great.
Wonderful.
This was so much fun, Jen.
I aim to make people happy in every way possible. That's my goal.
You're succeeding.
Doing a little jig in my chair that I basically live at now, doing 10 hours a day. Not as
Oh,
comfortable as
that's
the work
fun.
chair, but that's fine. Chris, how may people get in touch with you? Website, online presence. Do not forget the Twitter.
Can't forget the Twitter. On Twitter, I'm at Lives and Pages, all one word, Lives and Pages, LivesInPages. And my website is Chris-Gonzalez, GonzaleZ.com. But I live and die on Twitter, so you're more likely to get in touch with me there than anywhere else.
Are you on the gram? Are you on Instagram at all?
I am. I'm trying to be an Instagram person. I'm not really, but I'm on the gram and it's the same as my Twitter handle.
Okay, so that's also Lives and Pages. If anything, you could screen cap the tweets and keep putting them on Instagram. And there
That's
is a
true.
way to just seamlessly do that. So just screen capture and just like, Twitter, put this on Instagram.
Basically become a meme account, but the only memes are my tweets. I could do that. I could
Yeah.
steal my own content for
Yeah.
Instagram.
We might have given Instagram a $1 million idea. Of just like, if I could screen cap my tweets, I would be on Instagram more. Done.
Done seamlessly. I know. I mean, it's like Facebook and Instagram are the same. I guess Twitter is like hovering around that, but I don't know. They started fleets. They're all basically the same, except, Instagram isn't as text focused yet, but I believe it will be eventually. Give it time.
So once again, early December, we will be gifted with I'm Not Hungry, But I Could Eat, coming from SFWP Indie Press by Christopher Gonzalez. In the meantime, please follow him on the Twitter and the Instagram, why not? And check out his website to see his writing so you can get a taste, a lovely, delectable taste of his writing. And check out his interviews and other things that are coming up in Barrel House and all the work that he's given to Barrel House. And I just am very, very happy to finally talk to you, Chris. This has just been one of the best interviews I've had. And there's no offense to my guest.
Appreciate you saying it. This was a lovely evening, Jen. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. And thank you all for listening. Happy New Year again from Minorities in Publishing, AKA Jennifer, because it's just me.
Let them know.
Yeah, it's literally just me over here. Wishing you all lots of safety, lots of love, lots of joy.